Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and we are talking across the pond today. We've got a great author on, and joining me in the, as co-host today, we've got David North Martino. And if he puts down his whiskey and gun for a minute, maybe...
Oh, I'll do that right now.
Yeah, yeah, none of that. None of that, so, you know.
No.
Yeah. So terrible. It's terrible, man. And our guest, of course, is one of his books is called Murder in Mind, Investigations from a Yorkshire Crime Writer's Casebook. So, Stephen Wade. Well, thank you for being here, Stephen.
It's a pleasure.
Stephen, how did you get, because this is the first time on the show, so maybe people that don't know you, how did you become a writer? Like, what actually convinced you to start writing and publishing books?
Well, people in the States won't know me unless they're scholars of Jewish American literature, because that's, they're my, some of my first books when I was an English lecturer, and that was one of my special areas of research. So a very, very small number of Americans will probably know my name, those who read Saul Bellow and Philip Roth. I started writing, as most people do, when I was around about 20, and it was poetry. And I've written poetry ever since. I have a new collection out this September. So poetry is always in my life. But I really became a writer in terms of earning money and making a living, you know, round about the millennium. I think it was Mickey Spillane who said that there were writers and there were authors, and the difference is that writers get paid.
Yeah.
And I realized that when I got married. I thought, look, I'm going to have to write something that people actually want to read, and I might even earn a few pounds from it. So after the academic books and so on, I started to write. First of all, it was very small scale. It was, you know, local history, and then some case books of true crime, all British, of course, and very regional, you know, the shires, the provinces. And it was an editor who started me in that vein, because, as I say, my literature was my real subject. I was writing criticism. I did my doctorate. Actually, I did my doctorate on Christopher Isherwood, who, of course, is both a British and an American writer. And I understand he's not that far, is he, from where you are? Santa Monica, he lived in? My writing's always been really people. It's difficult to brand me as a writer, really, to be honest, because I tend to follow enthusiasms, and I always did right from the start. But that's really how I began as a serious writer. I wanted to make it my business and do far more than I'd just dabbled in before. So that would be round about late 90s, 2000, something like that. And they were just the first books, really, the first non-fiction books were just crime case books, mostly.
What made you go into crime? Like, why kind of select that? Like, what was it about crime that...
Well, it was an editor. I'd edited a book for... It was a Pen and Sword book. And I'd edited just a local history book, Yorkshire-based. And then the editor said, "What do you want to do for us now?" And of course, I hadn't thought about it. So I said, "Well, have you got a suggestion?" And he said, "Well, local crime's very popular. Do you want to have a go?" So what happened was I did... There's a series called Foul Deeds and Suspicious Deaths that Pen and Sword ran. I think they still do, actually. But it's a long time since I've written one. I did seven. And looking back, as you do as a writer, you learn so much every day. And I look back now and think, gosh, I just went in there without thinking. I didn't really know about research, and I had no background whatsoever. I was brazen and foolish. But I really enjoyed it. And I said to the editor after I got to, I think, number three, maybe something like that, said, "Look, I'm really starting to learn now about how you research crime history. We're talking archives,
right?
And wherever you can, talking to people who were witnesses." So I was really starting to broaden out how I conceived of a true crime book. And then what came along then, this is about 2003, so what then came along actually was I finished my university teaching. Full-time teaching, I should say. I went part-time. And I thought, I'm going to write, most of the time and then just lecture part-time. That was the University of Hull on the Humber.
Yeah.
And then I got a job as a writer in prisons. So just 30 miles away from where I live. So from that point, about 2003, I was working in prisons as a writer and doing my true crime books. So I moved on then from the local case studies to more universal crime themes, if you like. And of course, I was working with every type of offender you could imagine, really. So I really did my learning then, behind bars. I really learned a lot then. I started to understand, much more profoundly about what criminal transgression, what it's all about and why it happens. So I like to think, I hope so anyway, my books got better and better with some real solid knowledge behind them,
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it makes a difference. I've seen that. I sometimes cringe to look back at some of my earlier books because I know that I was not that good.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I wasn't. Not about you. I wasn't. I wasn't that good either. I really wasn't. I just thought, well, if it's a story, it should be all right. But what I didn't realize is just how many sources there are, mm-hmm. and how they could all be dodgy ones. Actually, a very strange thing happened. A really interesting thing. When I was still lecturing part-time at Hull University, I taught a creative writing class, and it's while I was writing a book, I can't remember which book it was, but I asked the class about themselves. I was just meeting them, really, and this guy said he was a doctor, and I said, "Tell me a bit about yourself." He said, "Actually, I was the last doctor to treat one of the crays."
Oh.
So I said, "Come and see me at coffee time."
Yeah.
Because, I'm sure you're aware, aren't you? That
the Cray twins, yeah.
In Britain, people are just rabid for stories about the craze.
Yeah.
So that that was a real turning point, actually, because speaking to him, I thought, good Lord, it is possible to still find people who are part of these great stories. You know, they're still around. Nobody had ever spoken to him before about it.
It's the super important thing. Even nowadays with the internet and all this, you know, web stuff, it's so important to talk to people that were involved and part of the crime. To get that first source, primary source, is a major, major step.
Absolutely. I think probably one of my best ones was when I was researching an unsolved murder not far from me on the North Lincolnshire, not far from the coast, North Lincolnshire. Way back, 1969 it was, an old man had been murdered by two intruders. He was an antiques collector. Anyway, I advertised, and sure enough, I got a letter from a retired police officer, and he said, you know, the Stevenson case. He said, I sat in the ambulance with him, and I took his dying declaration. You know, so I thought, wow, gift from God for a crime writer.
Yeah.
So I went to interview him, you know, and he told me all about it. It's still unsolved. It's a really cold case. It's, you know, it's so cold, it's Arctic, and I don't think we'll ever sort that one out.
Does that worry you? But when you get into, do you get too involved in sometimes when you're involved in a crime like that that's unsolved?
Oh, Alan. I take it you're familiar with Michelle McNamara.
Yes.
That's me.
Oh.
So it depends what case, but if there's something that really grabs me, it'll be a touch of the Michelle McNamara's. And I do have... The answer to your question is yes. Partly because I always like to try to get to the crime scenes and spend quite a bit of time there, the murder scenes, if I can. And what happened, the one case I would really say yes to, and I'm still at some point I'm going to write about this. It was way back in 1926, and it was, it's one of these cases you have, you know, where, you're convinced that an innocent person was hanged. You know those cases?
Yeah.
And although it's a long time ago, I really got involved in it. I still am. And it was from my hometown. It happened in Leeds. One day, it's going to be in print. I've written about it briefly, but what happened was I managed to get hold of the police records. And so, I now know so much about it, and some of the things I know about it I don't think are known by anybody else, never been in print and so on, so I'm convinced that an innocent woman went to the noose there. I know that's happened many, many times, but that one in particular, you know, to say yes to your question, that one is really near my heart, because she was born, actually, just a couple of streets away from where my mother was born. So I had a real connection to the story. And it was all complicated as well, because it took place in 1926 when there was a general strike in Britain. So it was eclipsed, really, in the papers, rather. You know, there were some reports, but it sort of went unnoticed, really, because there was so much trouble in the streets at the time. But the answer's a big yes to that question, Alan. I do get involved. I get really involved. And, I'm a terrier with a bone. And actually, that particular story has been on BBC TV. And I did some help. You'll see my name there as an archivist. And I did, I did help them with some material. But it's still something I am going to write about.
I was going to say you should bring it to that show, Murder, Mystery in My Family, you know?
Yeah, that's it. It's been on there.
Oh, yeah. It has?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, if you look at that, you'll see my name just down as an archivist. But anyway, what happened with that was they didn't film my I was involved, you know, and they filmed me doing a particular scene in Leeds, and then they didn't use it because it was replicating the same thing that someone else had dealt with. So in the end, I was just helping them with archives. But there's so much more to say about it. I know there are a thousand cold cases like this. I know there are. You know, they're happening all the time. But to an individual writer, when it gets hold of you, you really do get the Michelle McNamara's. I understand exactly what happened to her, how she was drowning in paper, wasn't she, for the the Golden State Killer. she was, you know, it was stopping her from sleeping at night, and I understand that obsession completely.
Oh, so did they find it safe or unsafe, the conviction?
They found it safe. The reason why they found it, the reason why they found it safe, was that they didn't have the complete records. What it is in a nutshell, the man that I think was, well, the police thought was the number one suspect, didn't figure in the, you know, the TV investigation.
Right.
He was mentioned briefly, but there was no mention of him being a major suspect. I know that he was a major suspect. I've got the evidence. So that's the that opens up my angle on it, you know. Chances are he went to Canada, I think.
Might be a neighbor.
Yeah. Under an assumed name.
He's a radio host.
But he disappears, like so many of them. But the other thing is, as well, you know, I have to mention, I'm so obsessed. I've written a novel as well that is based on this. So I just have to watch this space, really, Alan, because it's with my agent. And the agents have not been doing anything for over a year since COVID struck. So, you know, the novel was sort of, it was just about to drop on the publisher's desk, and COVID came along, so I'm still waiting on that one. My agent's still looking for that, doing something with it.
Get you, on your agent.
Do you prefer writing true crime, or did you want to go more into fiction?
I've always written fiction, and mostly short stories when I was younger. A few on radio, lots of anthologies and things. I've written a couple of crime novels. They're just e-books. And I've written westerns, of course. I told you that, didn't I?
Yeah.
Did I tell you that?
That's right.
Yeah, I've written 9 westerns.
Wow.
I've written 3 under my name, but they were e-books, I think. And then 6, you know, straightforward ones. Actually, I mean, I always joke with, you know, my friends in Montana. I sort of laugh at myself, really, because they're Brits westerns, you see. I say, they're an Englishman's western, I tell them. You know, think of cream bagels. If there are cow punchers, they don't often punch cows. They're usually shooting people. So it's very much the westerns. I'm not writing them anymore because the publisher's folded now. But I love writing them. I've just written a young adult western, so that'll be looking for a publisher now.
Well, you know, they do well in places, because I know I've got another interview with someone, I think, next week that writes westerns. Certain people do fairly well with their western writing.
Yeah, they do. But it's very marginal, isn't it?
It's very marginal. Yeah, yeah.
It's very, very tough for a Brit to be convincing in these things.
Vegetarian Brit.
Vegetarian Brit, even worse. I can only think of one. recent British writer who succeeded is so rare. Because, you know, when you've got people like Ibsen around, and, you know, there's wonderful Western writing around, and you can't compete with it if you don't exist within the culture. So,
you'd have to come.
It's a boys. I let my boy's imagination go if I write a Western.
Right, right. And you'd have to really come and you know, go to Texas or something and live there for a while and kind of absorb the way, you know, everything.
You would.
And,
you would.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, because normally the Brits, like me, I mean, one of the first Western writers I ever read was a librarian from Chesterfield. and I'm now in that category.
Yeah. Well, no, we all do what we can.
Yeah. I mean, it's like a boys' club. You can't really join the, you know, the fictioneers, the Western fictioneers. You wouldn't be eligible to join them because you've never really done any branding or, you know, rounded up any rough steers. So it's no good. You're sitting in an office in Lincolnshire. It's not good enough.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
No, the true crime really has taken over in my writing because you'll probably see on Amazon that it'll be about three years will it be now. I started writing books with an ex detective, and we've done we're just doing our fifth now. We've done some crime reference books, and they're doing really well. I think they're doing well, you know, everywhere that. Whenever people are writing crime fiction, you know, that's our market, really, for crime fiction writers and fiction readers, and true crime readers, of course. Because, you know, there's the best way to explain it is, I don't know if it's the same in the States, but certainly here, there's a kind of a middle ground in the readership that, say you want to write a contemporary crime novel, and you need to get all the facts right, you've got law books and you've got criminology books, and they're very serious and scholarly and dense and full of footnotes and strange, difficult language. And then there's this, you know, there's this gap on the shelf, if you like, or there's a grey area. So we went for that, because he's a detective. He was a London detective, was Stuart. And all I've got, the only thing I can offer is I know about prisons, but I'm not a lawyer. You know, I'm an amateur crime historian, but put the two of us together, and we're really doing well with the books. You'll see them on Amazon. That we're really pleased that they're finding so many readers. So we've just done the fifth one's just about to go through, I think now, and that's been brilliant, and that's made me, you know, that's confirmed my main writing identity at the moment. As a true crime writer, despite all these other things I do, that's confirmed the fact, you know, that it's my central interest, and I'll probably do more. I'm always planning a new one.
Yeah, you always have to be, because you keep going, you know.
I
can't shut it off. But, you know, this Murder in Mind, you really kind of focus on Yorkshire and Peter Sutcliffe, right?
That's it.
That's an interesting. Peter Sutcliffe is you know, quite the known killer, you know, the Yorkshire Ripper throughout the world.
Yeah.
Well,
of course,
he
figures in it. You know, he figures in it. But there's such a huge literature on him anyway. But
yeah.
I come from Leeds, as I said, so, and I've worked in West Yorkshire, so I know just about all the crime scenes you can imagine from the Yorkshire Ripper. You know, I've walked past them every morning. I've played football on them, you name it. I know those. And one of his victims was a woman from the village where I was brought up. So I did have some, you know, some personal recollections. And I mean, one typical, I could talk to you for hours, but one very typical one is there's a place, when he was, you know, the usual trajectory of this type of killer, you know, the you're starting off with voyeurism and then masturbation over the corpse. You know, that usual trajectory. Stealing underwear from the washing line. Mainly the phase of voyeurism. And there's a big area of Leeds called Soldiers Field, which is where a lot of the sport goes on. You know, cricket, soccer, tennis, you name it. It's a big sport area. And one of his first attacks and victims was on the edge of this Soldiers Field. And when I was young and fit, I used to play soccer. I used to be a winger, you know, the fast bloke on the wing. it was right next to a pitch where we played this crime scene. Oh. And, you know, it was more or less contemporary. In other words, I just moved away from Leeds as it sort of hotted up, you know, and the Ripper tape. You know about the Ripper tape, don't you?
A little bit, not as much. Yeah.
Let me explain. There was one of the biggest things in the Yorkshire Ripper story. You'll find masses of information on it, really. Was that someone produced a tape which was ostensibly the voice of the Ripper, and it was in a Geordie accent, in other words, Tyneside, Newcastle.
Right.
Tyneside accent, a very distinctive British accent. So therefore, the West Yorkshire police were then convinced this tape was genuine, and they broadcast it everywhere, supermarkets, cinemas. The whole country knew this Geordie voice on this Ripper tape. So what the police leading the team after Sutcliffe did was take it to the experts. Took this tape to the experts, the dialect experts. Now, as it happens, by sheer chance, you know, when I finished my first degree, which was in Wales, I did an MA degree in dialectology at the University of Leeds. And my tutor was a man called Stanley Ellis. Now, Stanley Ellis was one of the two experts that analysed the Ripper tape. And he's so good. He was so talented, this Stanley Ellis. He not only said that it was a genuine Wearside. It was a Wearside voice, you know, not Tyneside. There's the River Tyne and the River Wear, both up in Northumberland. And he pinpointed it to Wearside. Not only did he pinpoint the voice to Wearside, but he gave the town, the small town, that this voice would be from. And he was right.
Hmm.
But, unfortunately, it was a hoax.
Oh.
And, of course, the real Yorkshire Ripper was busy slaughtering other young women while this was going on, and of course then the leading detectives in the case were absolutely disgraced, you know, by I mean, it wasn't the dialect expert's fault. He just told them it was where the voice was from. That's all Stanley Ellis did, you know. But the leading detectives did a leap of logic and assumed that because, you know, that voice was the Ripper. And it wasn't. It was a man called John Humble, who was much later arrested. He's now died. And, of course, John Humble was responsible for, I think, four deaths, really, by making that stupid tape. But anyway, Stanley Ellis was my tutor when I did my dialectology degree. And, you know, I remember a lot about him, and I remember how brilliant he was. He was quite a national figure at the time, because he used to be on radio and TV. You know, on the sort of entertaining language side. You know, he was really good on, you know, grammar, linguistics. People used to send questions, you know, about the language. So he was an incredible guy. He should be better known, Stanley Ellis. Should be better known.
No, yeah, but things like that tend to not be as popular as something like Kim Kardashian, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
You know,
there's a crime.
There's a crime. Are we, you know, are we going to talk about, you know, Prince Harry and his wife? And, you know, people just get carried away with things that are not really anything. You know what I'm saying? They don't get, you know, they're not achieving anything from that. It's just sort of that, which is fine, but you've kind of got to have both. But there seems to be a lack of, I don't know, just a lack of wanting to get oneself better, you know.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There is, yeah. And there's not much of the critical attitude around either when it comes to media. This brings us back to true crime.
Because I'm
really interested in the theory. One of my big interests is in the theory behind it, you know, the psychology. And so about 3 years ago, not long before the COVID, I did a lecture in Liverpool. It was a convention on Jack the Ripper studies. And I did a lecture on the code of deviance and kind of the nature of transgression. And, you know, with a kind of a Freudian angle. And I've got a very strong interest in the German, you know, the Middle European angle on true crime, criminology. Very interested in that. I've always read a lot of Middle European, you know, particularly Viennese and Berlin. It stemmed from when I did my doctorate and I had to study 1930s Berlin. It started there because Christopher Isherwood, when he lived in Berlin, there was an institute in Berlin run by Magnus Hirschfeld, and it was for the study of sexology. It was, you know what Berlin was like in the 30s, you know, cabaret, all that. Well, there was an institute for sexual studies run by this guy Hirschfeld. And this was the era, of course, during the Weimar Republic, when some of the most significant serial killers emerged, cannibals, some of them. Absolutely horrendous killers. And I got particularly interested in that with regard to understanding the psychology behind extremely cruel, deviant, violent crime. I often looked at, say, for example, Stefan Georg, who wrote a lot about this, or Georg Grosch, the artist. And there was a deep fascination with serial killers. And strangely, coming back to the States, an awful lot of the thinking behind this goes back to Edgar Allan Poe.
Right.
He wrote a wonderful piece, do you know it, called The Man in the Crowd? Do you know that?
I should know it.
I should too.
Man in the Crowd. Read it. If you don't know it, read it immediately for true crime understanding, because God knows how Poe understood this. You know, with what a genius he was. I mean, he had no training, no academic foundations in this, but he has this. He said, this old man that he writes about. He said, this old man is the type and the genius of deep crime. And he's observing this man in the crowd, and he sort of explained this feeling, you know, that there's a type of deviance that only we understand. You know, a 100 years on, we understand it, but Poe seemed to grasp that these horrendous killers, like the ones in the 1930s, these German cases, you know, as they were going to be. I mean, I just can't believe Edgar Allan Poe. He was such a visionary. And when you look at those, you know, some of the great literature and the great art from the 30s, they you can see they stem from this. There's one of the greatest novels ever written, The Man Without Qualities, by Robert Musil, has a character in it called Moosbrugger. And he's a horrible, sadistic killer. And Robert Musil writes him in as this Poe-like figure. No one understands him, but he has this charisma. And it's like a profile of every serial killer you've read about. And this is Robert Musil writing in the 1930s. It's wonderful stuff.
No, but I was just wondering, because I've just been looking into Fritz Haarman.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right, the Love Bites and all that. Mm. What exactly, like, why does it happen in certain areas like that? Why is, in, for instance, Germany, you have so much of the blood, flesh-eating and sort of murders going on in one area that it's not happening anywhere else? There's murders.
Exactly,
and there's serial
killers.
But what do you think it is about that area? Is there something, is it the water? Like, what?
Yeah, you do wonder, don't you? I think a lot of it is down to the war, isn't it?
Right.
If you look at some of the conditions, about 10 years ago, it's an interesting little story, I picked up a photographic archive. I just got it in a flea market. And it was an archive from a German Jewish family. And it went from the 1890s right through, I'm talking about the photograph, you know, the photographs themselves, went from there through the Great War. So there were about 120 pictures, all from the front line on the Italian front in the Great War. And then right up to the States, the generation in the family that ended up in New England. And the pictures here, these are unpublished photographs, these are family photographs of the front line, and of a Krankenhaus, a Feld Krankenhaus, a little hospital, field hospital on the very front line. And you look at some of these pictures and you think, yes, barbarity. If you would, you know, the roots of the barbarity, some of the answers to your question, Alan, I think, are in the Great War, and the depth of depravity in the Great War. I mean, there are lots of good memoirs that touch on this, you know. I don't think it's the full answer to your question, but it's something I've always assumed is part of the answer. God only knows where what the specific circumstances were in the German cities. But there's another part of an answer there, isn't there, to your question? I mean, you've asked a huge question there. But certainly, it is interesting why, though, isn't it? Because, you know, why cannibalism? That's one... That's a factor in it. Georg Grosch, the artist, has two pictures. He did a book called Love. In English, it's Love Above All, and it's a book of sketches from the Weimar Republic. And he has two pictures, which he calls Thymension, two people. And the first picture shows a man feeding booze to a lady in some sort of little decadent room or something. And the picture next to it is the woman's decapitated body on the bed, and the guy with a huge knife in the sort of food preparation part of the flat. And he just calls it two people. you know, and again, it comes from this culture you're asking your question about. You know, why? So maybe the war's part of it, but it's only a small part of it. It's interesting that Isherwood, because, you know, Isherwood, when he was in Berlin, stayed in a working-class area called Nollendorfplatz. And so he met the everyday Germans. He stayed with a working-class family and a landlady with a sort of a the cheapest one, you know, that he could afford. He was up there teaching English, very little money. And he met, you know, this subculture, the homosexual subculture, the clubs. He went to the Hirschfeld Institute and so on. And he, in his memoirs, detects this. He has a lot to say about, you know, this. We all go on about this underbelly, etc., etc. But what really was it, and why was it so barbarous, you know? So it's something I've often thought about because of my interest in the German writing. And I'll tell you a great place to look if you don't know them, right? Philip Kerr. Philip Kerr's novels, I don't know whether you know them. He died, I think, last year. I'd recommend these to anybody, Alan. Just anything by Philip Kerr. He had it's a long series of novels, and the narrator is a German detective, and it goes through this period right up to the Cold War. And there's tons about this in Philip Kerr. So there is a massive literature. I don't know what the professional criminologists would give as their answer.
But yeah, well, you know, they don't know anyway. But
no, and we can't understand what they write, can we? It's too complicated.
No, it gets too deep.
Full of long words.
Yeah, I have to stop and look them up. But I think it's fascinating how each area has its own type of community killing, you might say, or community, how they deal with death. And even the resurgence in this true crime in the last 10 years of how it's so popular. There's networks and TV shows and books, and it's just crazy. And people are fascinated with murder.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, why? Why? Yeah. That's what Murder in Mind is. Yeah, that's what I was partly trying to write about. But I could do with writing another one now because there's so much else to say.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's a book called, what's it called? The Fact of a Body. I don't know if you know it. Anyway, and a part of that book is a profile of this character who kills a little boy. And in the book, it's by Alexandria Lesnovich, I think. And in the book, the killer, who's what's the polite way to say it? Educationally challenged. We used to say educationally subnormal when I was young. I think you can't say that now, can you? But this character in the book, who's killed the boy, says the police asked, you know, did you kill him? And this character called Langley, he says, I couldn't tell you. I'm still fumbling with it in my mind. It's like I knew I did it, but it's like something you read in the newspaper.
Mm.
You know, and that's... It's the fantasy element. I think why we love true crime, if you get to the bottom of it, it's something about our intrigue with the nature of a fantasy that's generated, we know not how. You know, if we knew the how they were generated, I mean, Freud had his theories, but they're so difficult to follow. He talks about screen memories, creating false memories with your childhood memories. It's incredibly complicated, but he does have an answer if you're patient enough to, you know, if you've got the time to try to follow his thinking through. He does have an answer. But for ordinary folk like us who pick up a true crime magazine, you know, this fantasy, it's like I often used to see it with people that I'd worked with. You know, I did work with quite a number of killers. And I often used to, when they were writing, I was there, you know, to help them with whatever writing projects in prison they wanted to do, whether it was their life story or storytelling or run a magazine. I was there to help them, just, you know, not like a teacher, but just as support for them. And I often had people who'd taken a life. You often found that they were cultivating every day. The ones who had, you know, a degree of remorse, and they were cultivating every day some kind of feeding of an alternative reality that sustained them. if they could keep feeding that other reality, which was so for them, they wouldn't have to look at the reality in front of them. And so you always had a clue from the things on the walls of the cell. As soon as you go in a cell, you look at what's on the wall. You look at the artwork, the postcards, drawings, doodling, letters, calendars, and it's there. It's the fantasy there, you know. And again, I'm not a criminologist, but
in a way, they're putting themselves in the murderer that they did. They put them as a third person. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
This new fantasy, this new narrative they're going, going to live through. But you want to talk about him? That's the guy that killed.
That's it. Yeah, that's right.
You know.
T.S. Eliot, isn't it? Humankind cannot bear much reality.
Right.
We do everything we can to avoid the reality that hits us in the face. And for example, one of the commonest things you found with murderers was religion, was some kind of faux spirituality.
Right.
You get a lot of Buddhists. funny how murder creates Buddhists.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they all find Jesus in prison.
Yeah. That's for the tea and biscuits in the chapel. Yeah. I know what you're saying. Yeah, it's true. It's a complicated thing, isn't it?
It certainly is. Well, what did you want people to get? When someone picks up Murder in Mind, for instance, and they read it, what is it kind of wanted them to take away from it? Like, other than the main, when you're talking about Peter Sutcliffe or the Hangman and all that stuff. But besides the direct story, is there something you wanted people to take away from Murder in Mind?
Yes, yes. I didn't do it in any deep way. I just did it as a bit of straight memoir. But it's that we all encounter transgression, and we know we most of us have some sort of notion of right and wrong when we're little, probably. Yeah. Maybe that's reducing every day the way the world is, but back in my world, my generation, we certainly did. And when there was a transgression, you know, the demarcations were clear then. And I'd like readers to sit back and consider how their experience compared with mine. Because, you know, I'm an old man now. And I'm writing about a time, such a long time ago, when law and crime, when transgression were very, very different things. You know, I was born just after the war, and most of my childhood memories have some kind of link with people who'd come back from that war, and or went away to another war. You know, because we were still fighting England, wasn't we? We were still fighting in the 1950s and so on. So it was an awful lot of duty demanded of us, and an awful lot of obedience demanded of us, and it was a culture that feared the law and feared the police. And there was instant retribution if there was a transgression. There was physical retribution. You know, I was hit every day at school. And that's what the 50s were like. So I'd like people to take away, you know, some sort of insight into how the world has changed in that 50, 60 years there between that and the millennium, if you like, in terms of how we see transgression, any kind of transgression. Because, you know, as an historian, which I am mainly, most of my stuff relates to history, I can see over the centuries just how, different circumstances have made the law more or less complacent with whatever rules at the time, you know, in terms of transgression. You know, is it a transgression to do so and so? I mean, just one quick reference that comes to mind that would be what you take away from Murder in Mind, would be that how you first receive, how the individual first experiences the consequences of any transgression. To look at that and think hard about that. you know, because it can have immense consequences, because it's sort of forming a moral center somehow. Sorry, I'm going on.
No, it's interesting. I know we had Peter Voronsky on, and he writes a lot about that, and a lot about how the generations such as yours that come out of the war, whose parents were in the war, for instance, or things like that, the relationship between you and your father is much different than a father and son today.
Oh, massive, yeah. Yes, right? huge difference. Yeah, he'd been a boy sailor on the minesweepers, and he told me practically nothing. He gave me about three facts. He claimed that he'd bought Yvonne DiCarlo a drink. I don't know whether I believe him or not, but you know, I got three facts. I think he thought Seattle was the most beautiful place on earth. And he didn't like being in Malta when it was bombed. That's about all I got from his war.
Right.
But with regard to what I've been waffling on about, he and his, I'm sorry to use this word because it's difficult for American people, but class, you know, in British terms, you know what class is like.
Oh, yeah.
What a burden class is to us. You know, I'm working class. I was born working class. My mum and dad were working class. And his nature, you know, if you're talking about the morality and you know, where our sense of what a crime is, where it comes from, he had a very, very firm view of right and wrong. And, you know, Victorian, still essentially Victorian.
Yeah.
And he did it very, very rarely that he punished with his fist if he had to. And, you know, my grandparents had belts above their fire. And the belts were there just as a warning that you right behavior was required or the belt would come off the mantelpiece.
Yeah.
So it's Victorian English morality, and it's right is right and wrong is wrong, and there will be severe punishment. And, of course, I lived in a culture that had capital punishment, and you could live, you know, we had physical punishment. We had kids being birched in Borstal prisons. So, you know, to modern people, I don't know what young people now would think of them.
Well,
Britain in
they're
the
50s. They're having problems with a lot of things that our generations and even earlier did, because they don't understand the concept of growing up in that world. They don't understand because they're not there. They're here now. And
that's
they look
it.
And they go, well, how can you be like that? How could you have said that? How could you have done this? And it's like, well,
yeah,
if
absolutely.
You only knew, you didn't live it. You don't understand it until you're there.
That's it.
You know,
yeah.
So when it comes to things like that, there's too much of a distance, I think.
Yeah,
You know,
but at least I hope... Sorry.
No, I was going to say, I grew up much the same as you did, atmosphere. We had the belt.
Yeah.
And we'd have to go pick up the belt and bring it to my dad, and then he would beat us with it, right?
Yeah. Oh, enlightened times, Alan.
Yes.
Enlightened times.
My dad used the stick so that the stick would break, and because he knew his hand wouldn't.
Oh, didn't have
Oh, bullets, right. But... Oh, he was more humane. He was
more humane. Exactly.
Yeah, you know.
No, they were very, very strange times, the 50s, weren't they? You know, I'm glad they're so long ago. But, I mean, you know, just to finish that point, you know, the murder in mind, well, it's not meant to be anything deeply theoretical.
Right.
It's just a memoir element in it that touches on this, that's all.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I would like to, at some point in the future, I might write a more extensive account of what I've been going on about, but there's plenty of criminology around. You know, there are enough academic criminologists to keep us busy already, aren't there?
Well, there are, but it's a good thing to have a little bit more of a down to earth explanation and a little bit, you know, easier to use examples and to talk to people. So there's room for that kind of a book, because right now it's one, you know, it's one or the other. So.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good thing.
It is, yeah. I mean, you can never have enough when it comes to explaining something as really complex as crime and law. I mean, when I first started writing, it all seemed so straightforward. You know, oh, yes, well, you know, that happened in 18-something or other. Everybody knew what the world was like. You knew what to expect if you did that or that. But then, when you look at historians and how they write about it today, you get some absolutely egregious things go wrong, don't you? You know, recently, for example, I'm not going to mention any detail because it might be, it might get into trouble.
But
well, you know, there's it was in the paper a little while ago. A writer called Naomi Wolf, who's Oxford, I think, Oxford graduate. You probably read it. I don't think the story was confined to our Sunday papers. But she completely misread criminal records from the Victorian period and assumed that certain types of criminals had been executed when in fact they hadn't. And it formed the basis of a book, didn't it? I'm sure it's on the net. I've not looked, but probably all over the internet, because it was a boo-boo that got her into trouble. But the point I make, I'm not picking on her, I'm just saying how easy it is to misread the past, even if you're a doctor of philosophy or whatever she is. It's still possible, you know, we all get things wrong. But it's such a complicated thing, the history of crime and how it... The context, or the shifting context of it, Alan. That's what I'm going on about. The shifting context.
Well, that's the most important part, right? The context of it. Because the things, I think the ones that get it wrong the most are the ones that don't get into the time that they're writing about.
That's it, exactly. That's
right?
It. Yeah, that's it.
Because then you miss...
I mean, that's exactly where my conversation with you started, when I said about the first writing I did. You know, that's what I wasn't doing. So, hopefully I just learned by... doing.
Well, that's how we all gain forward. You know, the main thing is we're moving forward. We gain and we get better at what we do because of what we've done. So I think that's, you know.
And you know, as a wonderful positive example of what's one of the reasons why you get real pleasure from writing true crime or crime history is when you get something down an archive that's, you know, very human. And, you know, it's not just a piece of paper. And when you were talking then, I was just remembering. I was once in an archive. It was actually, believe it or not, it was a book. I was writing a book on the Zulu War. And I was down in this archive, and I had this bunch of letters from an English aristocratic mother to her son in Natal. And there were flowers, dry flowers. In his letters back to her, there were dried flowers, and you know, I thought there's a little tiny piece of Natal here, and it's part of this story where, you know, the poor woman, he was only in his teens, he died of dysentery, so he went to fight the Zulus and died of dysentery, and there down an archive is a little envelope with these tiny bits of flowers dried in them. It's just one of those wonderful little moments, you know why you do what you do. It's kind of human side of it all.
So now, do you run a website of your own? Do you have your own website, or?
I have a website. Yes, I have a website. This last year, because of the COVID, I have a very nice friend who does the website for me, and you know, I send her information that I want to put on it. But because of this last year, obviously, as I say, with my agent not being able to do anything either, it's there's not much going. I mean, you know, I usually do lots of events.
Well, this has certainly been a pleasure. I've got to wrap up the hour because the hour has come to a close.
It has been a pleasure. Thank you. Yeah.
Murder in Mind was kind of what we were talking about. Author we're talking about is our guest, Stephen Wade. Thank you for being here.
It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Ring again anytime. I shall be in my den, probably writing about Germans.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.